Where else can you go to not only find the information on how to train your dog, but the best deals on training equipment as well? Standing Stone Supply has everything you need to create that next versatile champion, from DT system electronics down to even emergency med kits to take with you on your hunting trips. If you need some help with your training program, then their step-by-step online course might be a great fit for you, making it a convenient one-stop shop for the knowledge as well as the gear to take your training to the next level. Hit up standingstonesupply.com and promo code GDIY will save you 10%.
As someone who constantly travels to new locations out of state to hunt, I have to rely on map scouting before I even get in the truck. Onyx Hunt Maps makes it super easy for me to plan out my trips as well as track my success while on the trip. The offline maps, along with the tracking feature and ability to add pictures to my waypoints, means I can always reference old trips and hunts to better prepare for the next. When planning your next hunt, be sure to use Onyx to put you and your dog in the best situation you can. Use code GDIY20 at checkout to save 20% and know where you stand with Onyx.
All right, everybody. I am joined this week with Tom Brownlee out of Helena, Montana. You want to go ahead and just kind of introduce yourself and tell everybody what you do?
Sure. I'm an adjunct professor at Carroll College in the Anthrozoology Department. I specialize in canine track. We have canine and equine. I do some of the canine. I'm also a certified law enforcement canine instructor through the American Society of Canine Trainers, certified nationwide. So pretty much the short version.
Yeah. So you wear a few hats in the canine world. Kind of tell us, what's your average day like? Are you working with dogs, or are you just teaching about them? Walk us through your regular day.
Right now I am teaching a specialized class on canine olfaction science, forensics, and the law. That class meets three times a week. The rest of the week, I'm retired and or helping previous students train dogs, because a lot of them have gone into the profession.
Well, let's kind of just dive right on into the course that you teach then. You mentioned the olfaction. Let's start there. What do you mean by olfaction? Is that really just another word for how dogs' noses work?
Pretty much. Yeah, except we approach it, of course, from a scientific angle. And we like to base what we teach on university research, but we like to know, especially for my course in working dogs, you need to know exactly how this stuff works for court testimony purposes. If you're dealing with canine, if you're dealing with human remains, you're dealing with search and rescue, then you need to know.
How in depth do you go into this to where you know like how dogs' noses actually physically work? I know you have a bunch of experience in how it relates to training and getting the dog to really see the world through their nose, but can you kind of summarize and break down how a dog's nose actually works for us?
First thing probably to put in your mind is VOCs, which is volatile organic compound. Everything is composed of volatile organic compound. It depends on how much of those that get emitted by that object or by that animal or by anything. So that's the key to everything, and especially if we get into tracking. So that being said, the only thing a dog is physiologically capable of smelling is an airborne molecule. If it isn't a gaseous molecule, they can't smell it. It's not physically possible. So I'll try to give you the Reader's Digest abridged version. When a dog's just walking around being a dog, we call that general scenting capability. At that point in time, 5% of the air that he is taking in is actually getting sampled for scent, only 5%. Now, when he detects something or recognizes something that he thinks needs further investigation, they will go into what we call a rapid sniff mode. Anybody who's been around a dog knows what I'm talking about. When that happens, air gets routed up and over the respiratory tract. So the whole nasal system is divided into two tracts. One's respiratory and one is olfactory. So general scenting capabilities, they're sampling 5% of the air going in. Once they go in this rapid sniff mode, they are sampling 12 to 13% of the air for odorants. And on top of that, you've more than doubled what gets sampled. They're also, that increases their rate of respiration by 3. So things start to progress almost geometrically as far as the dog being able to pick up odors. So that's the first thing. That whole rapid sniff, you've heard it with a dog. Some dogs' noses even will make an audible click as they go through that. What it is what we call the alar fold in each nostril.
Yeah.
And that is what actually routes the air up and over into the olfactory tract.
So with that, you know, you mentioned a couple things in there. First off, I'm kind of curious just for people listening and relating it back to ourselves. Are we the same way in that we can only smell gaseous molecules and then also the percentage of the air that we're taking in? Is that kind of similar to us, or do the dogs just take in more scent than us?
Good question, because actually when the dog goes into rapid sniff mode, he is cycling air at 4 to 7 hertz, which is cycles per second. That's what's going in his nose. And you've heard it. It's just...
Yeah.
Now, think about when you go to sniff something, you'll pick it up, put it to your nose, and go... Ours is exactly 1/10 of that. We have about 0.4 hertz per second. We're a whole lot slower. We also have the olfactory sensory neurons that actually pick up the odorant molecules. We have 5 million of those. And an average, if there is such a thing, an average dog has 220 million. That'll kind of give you a little idea how much better at it.
Yeah. So, and you just mentioned something, average dog. You know, we know that certain breeds genetically and just physiologically smell better than other breeds. But what about like dogs within the same breed? How much difference are there? You mentioned average dog. Is it really an issue of they all can't smell equally, or maybe just one hasn't been exposed and learned to use its nose as much as the other? Can you speak to that?
Glad that you addressed that, because it is a very common misconception that one dog will have a better nose than another. Well, we consider an average dog as a 50-pound dog with a basic traditional snout, okay? Mm-hmm. Little bitty dogs with a brachycephalic head like pugs and shih tzus, they, of course, will have less smelling gear. It's still remarkably better than a human, but it's a whole lot less. Then as far as one dog of a like kind being able to, you know, smell better than the next, not possible. The thing that determines how well they're going to hunt, or for us, how well they're going to detect contraband, is their drive level and your training. You have not made that scent, whatever you want to target on, salient to the dog, and have not ramped him up, because all the dogs, you guys are dealing with gun dogs and I deal with working dogs, they all have a high prey drive. You need to put that to work. It's actually easier for us because we have a different system of rewards for the dogs than for gun dogs. But that's what determines one dog being better than the next, is how much drive he has for the job and how you have taken advantage of that with your training.
Yeah. And I'm glad to hear that, because, you know, there's a lot of testing systems out there for these gun dogs, such as NAVDA. And NAVDA, on their natural ability test for their pups, it's not how good the dog's nose is, it's use of nose. How does that dog use the nose? Because you can't really determine how good the dog's nose is, but you can determine, like you said, the drive of the dog, the motivation, and the dog actually using its nose in the field.
Yeah, and I use my own, well, she's gone now, but I had a dog that I taught narcotics detection to. They're the border collie. They're not necessarily known for their olfactory ability, to be point blank. I thought her nose was an ornament. She never used it for anything until I started her on narcotics. And then reward involved. And to be quite blunt, she was as good as I've ever seen.
Wow.
And it all comes out because, you know, taking advantage of that drive.
She just needed that motivation. That's really all it was.
They used to use that nose, so they'll use it.
Well, real quick, you did mention that there were a couple factors that maybe made some breeds have less olfactory capabilities than others. What are some factors that can increase the olfactory capabilities? You know, a lot of the hound dogs, they have longer nose, and then a lot of people say longer ears help with scenting conditions. Is there any truth to that?
Well, there's no verifiable evidence of that. It makes sense, you know, in the case of bloodhounds. It makes some sense when you know how air is, you know, the molecules are gathered up, but it has never been verified. The other thing that I've run into that we can't get verification on, like I said, the average dog, we figure, and it's probably conservative, has 220 million olfactory sensory neurons. I have read accounts of, in particular, beagles and Springer Spaniels having 300 million. Haven't been able to verify that, and it's a smaller dog than we're dealing with, which does not make sense. So I don't know. But you've got gun dog guys know, the Springers in particular, can be extremely high drive. The British use them all the time for contraband work because they're non-intimidating and they will work like crazy with that nose.
Is there anything else that you feel like we should really touch on how the dogs work before we kind of get into different scenarios and how that impacts the dogs' scenting capabilities kind of while we're in the field or in hunting scenarios? Is there anything kind of on the physical front that we didn't touch on?
The only thing to probably bear in mind, two things to bear in mind in the field on the dog. I talked about the rapid sniff mode. Okay, we've all seen a dog do that. We've all seen a dog pant. Well, they use the same muscle groups for both. So when a dog is panting and they're too hot, it is physically impossible for them to be smelling at the same time. We have all seen them pant a few seconds and then start sniffing a few seconds. That's viable. But ordinarily speaking, when they're panting, you need to give them a little break before you put them back to work.
I'm glad that you brought that up because that is a very, especially I live down here in the South, I'm in Tennessee. And then while we're training in the summer, it is very quick for these dogs to start panting, especially if they're not in the best of shape. And some people, you know, they get frustrated because the dog's not acting right, quote unquote, around birds because they can't smell the birds. They're panting. And a lot of people don't recognize that while they're panting, they aren't smelling. And what you just said, they can stop panting, sniff for a couple seconds, but then they go back to panting. You know, picture that while we're running through the field trying to hunt when it's 90 something degrees out. While they may get in some scent and may get lucky and find that bird, it's you're asking a lot of that dog.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just not effective for them to try to pick up scent when they're panting.
Well, and that's kind of a good headway into the environmental section because, you know, we just talked about the heat that can lead to panting and all that, but there's a lot of environmental factors when it comes to how we train, test, and hunt these dogs that we do. You know, so I've got a few written down. I'd like to just kind of go down the line with you and get your take on how it really impacts the dogs. And we can kind of continue on what we just touched on is the temperature. You know, we kind of touched on heat. But also there's an element of cold too. How does the heat versus cold affect the dog's noses?
Very good question. When that air goes into the dog's nose and hits the first series of bones that do the sampling, which are called turbinates, part of that whole system in the nasal system is to warm that air sample that came in and to moisturize it. Because both, you have to bear in mind, we're talking airborne molecules. The things that increase the molecular movement are heat and pressure. And molecules will cling to moisture. They don't bond with it, but they cling to it. So that's the whole idea behind humidifying and warming the air sample. So on a warm day, you don't have to do as much of that. I mean, it's kind of a non-event. Cold day, the dog's natural ability takes care of that for you by warming that air sample. It gets further warmed when it goes to the rear of the nasal cavity, which is the ethmo terminates, which is where most of the sampling goes on. Temperature-wise, unless it is frigid cold, doesn't seem to make a difference.
So temperature, ultimately, at the end of the day, is not that big a deal. And so I'm wondering, you know, a lot of hunters and a lot of trainers, they'll sit there and say that, you know, there are different factors that affect on how well their dog smells. And, you know, they do mention heat and cold, but I'm wondering, since you just said temperature doesn't affect it, if it's other things that really kind of come along with the heat and cold that are really affecting it, you know?
Well, there is one actually with the heat. The heat does increase molecular movement. So if they are on a scent stream from an animal, for instance, it's going to dissipate faster in the heat. Heat is never your friend as far as the scent per se goes. Conversely speaking, it will seek out any areas that are cool, like shade, whatnot. So you will see the dog go off an obvious track on occasion, but he's not off of it. He's in the cool spot where the scent went.
Okay.
Okay. But it does, as I said, heat and pressure increase molecular movement, and that they're not your friend.
Okay, so you're talking about in the gaseous molecules that they smell, you're just saying when it gets hot, the gas molecules are naturally going to float on over into the shade, into the cooler area.
They can. Yeah, otherwise they just plain dissipate.
Is that kind of similar to big game hunters, they kind of pay attention a lot more to thermals and hunting thermals when they're dealing with deer and elk and so on and so forth. Is that kind of what you're getting into with this as far as the gas moving into cooler and hotter areas?
Absolutely. Well, thermals are convection currents rather than just a scent stream moving. They, as you well know, the thermals will go up in the morning when the ground gets heated up again because molecular movement speeds up and hot air rises.
Right.
In the evening, cool air falls. So thermal reverses, it goes downhill. It's very important out here to us in the mountains. Well, you follow that like crazy. So
I was told very early on when I got into this world that if, especially if you're hunting the mountains, if you're going early morning, start at the top and work your way down because that scent's going to be rising. And then conversely, if you're hunting in the afternoon, start lower and walk up the mountain. And it sets the dog up for success a little bit better. I was just going to go on, you know, straight from thermals into humidity. I'm curious because you said that part of the dog's nose function as it's breathing it in naturally moisturizes and humidifies the air. So when we're out with our dogs and we think that we see the dogs not smelling as well because it's a high humidity day, or conversely, like there's not enough humidity in the air during the winter, maybe. You know, how does that really affect if the dog's nose naturally does it on its own?
All right. I was saying the scent molecules will cling to moisture. Humidity is your friend. The dog will breathe it in. He won't have to humidify it as much as normal. He'll be able to work a little longer, a little sharper under humid conditions. When it's dry, not so much. So, humidity is always a good thing. I know a lot of your bird dog guys will tell you had nice right after a rain or a nice foggy morning, dog does real well. And that's part of the reason why. Like I said, it clings to the moisture. The moisture is in the air. You're not seeing any of the molecules, of course, but it's happening right in front of you.
Right. Makes sense. Move on to wind. You know, you hear all the time, there's not enough wind. My dog's not smelling great. And then you'll hear it on the opposite way. It's too windy. You know, the wind is blowing too hard. What's that kind of sweet spot? What's the minimum amount of wind, and then what's too much wind?
I couldn't tell you that part, but I can tell you what the basic rule is. Now, you have to bear in mind, I come from a place where we track people, not animals. Mm-hmm. The rule of thumb is every 1 mile an hour moves that scent from the animal 10 feet. So if you have 3 mile an hour wind, that dog can be literally 30 feet away from the track and still be on it if he is on the scent band. Now, the other part of that, of course, is if that track has aged very long, then that scent band is dissipated by the wind. But if you're on a fresh one, like you've just flushed a bird and dog goes after the singles or whatever, if it's on a fresh one, that's the rule of thumb. 1 mile an hour is 10 feet. So
awesome. I've never heard that rule. So I'm going to have to start paying attention to that, writing down wind direction and how hard it's blowing and see if there's any correlation to how far the dog points off the bird.
Yeah. And, you know, birds, bear in mind, before you call me an idiot, it's going to be different defined than people are. People will give a whole lot more scent from the ground up, and the bird not necessarily. Mm. So
what about green grass though? I've been hearing that since I got started. Is if the grass is too green, the chlorophyll sucks that scent down on the ground. Is there any truth to that?
I hope you're ready to take notes, because I actually wrote down grass. When a dog is tracking something like a big game animal, if they're doing, for instance, what they call blood tracking, doesn't necessarily involve blood. Grass, and when an animal passes, they damage that vegetation, whether it's grass or not. And I mentioned VOCs earlier. There are anywhere from 10 to 100 VOCs in any kind of vegetation. Grasses contain 2 to 300. What happens when it gets damaged is that chloroplast starts to leak and is immediately attacked by bacteria. The bacterial VOCs, because they will emit a VOC when they're consuming that damaged chloroplast. That's what the dogs are following for the most part, unless it's an animal that really leaves a lot of stink behind it. So those VOCs on a track for every, well, like I said, I'm tracking humans, but for every single human and environmental VOC, there's 22 to 82 bacterial VOCs. When the bacteria start to consume this damaged plant matter, it gives off, it's an umbrella term, but it gives off what we call diaminobutane. And that's pretty much the thing that the dogs are keying in on a track, per se. And like I said, it might be a little different for your birds, but if there's damaged vegetation, that's what's happened. But you have to bear in mind, you know, canines across board have evolved to determine where prey has been, where prey has eaten, where they can find it. And that's how they do it, by the environmental disturbance and the VOCs from the bacteria.
Have you ever shot a bird that just keeps on flying and you're standing there saying, I swear I hit that bird? Well, good news. Maybe it might not be you, but rather your shotgun. Go check out UplandGunCompany.com and construct the perfect shotgun that is not only built to your exact physical specifications, but your preferred looks as well. To some people, a shotgun not only has to perform, but look good while doing it also. Upland Gun Company has made this process super convenient and surprisingly affordable when you consider all of the completely customizable features. Get your shotgun order submitted today so you're standing there with your dog saying, fetch, rather than standing there still saying, I couldn't have missed that bird. No two hunters approach the field the exact same way. That's why it's nice to have a vest that can be completely customized to fit your specific needs. Final Rise creates high-functioning upland gear that delivers comfort and balance that assists you chasing wild birds in wild places. The vest's unique lumbar pad and weight-bearing waist belt makes it too easy to keep going to the next horizon. Add in any of the awesome and functional accessories for the vest along with their new tactical apparel, and you'll be outfitted with a complete setup that was proudly sourced and sewn right here in the USA. Check out FinalRise.com to order yours today.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
That's fascinating. So I recently just did an episode with a Maine search and rescue guy, and he was explaining how water can really change the scent and how it flows. And there's really nothing to disturb the scent molecules in the air because there's nothing for it to go around. It's just open. So we just talked about breaking grass and stuff like that. That can kind of disrupt some of the molecules. Is there anything like that in water that would affect us if we're trying to do a duck search or, you know, a track through water or something like that?
That's a good question, because what happens in water, water's H2O. The molecules are organized so that the O is up. The surface of water has got a layer of oxygen on it. Oxygen is what we consider a sticky molecule. Now, molecules won't bond to other molecules, but they will cling for a while. They will cling to oxygen. So when there is scent in water, the best analogy I can give you, if you've ever seen underwater fuse burn, when it comes to the surface, the bubbles break and the smoke dissipates very gradually, according to wind or current or both. That's exactly what the molecular movement does on the surface of the water. It'll be there, but it'll start to dissipate depending on wind and current.
Well, all of this is fascinating because, I mean, it really is just like any type of hunting, especially in the dog world. You have these tailgate biologists and you can sit there and debate, and one person swears something matters and the other person doesn't. So it's really interesting to get your take on it that's, you know, actually studied and it's science. So, you know, it kind of clears some stuff up and questions in my head. Now I want to kind of touch into you're clearly knowledgeable on how the dog's noses work, but I want to touch on your experience with training the dogs with that knowledge. So, you know, what can we do as dog trainers to really bring that dog's drive and enthusiasm with that nose? Like we talked about, it's more about the drive and the use of nose. How can we early on with a puppy, or we just got a new dog, how can we start to develop that practice and getting the dog working with its nose more?
Hey, I was thinking about this. I knew you were going to ask that. What we do with scent detection dogs, with tracking dogs that are tracking people, you don't really have the luxury of doing with a gun dog. what we do is we get an interactive toy. You get a tug toy, you get a ball, something the dog loves to play with you on the other end. Okay, that's his reward. There's no treats. There's no, that's the reward for a prey drive dog. And we yank the dog around on that, give him his reward, tell him he's wonderful, you know, all that good stuff. And we have found through studies that we've done, if you do that for 30 seconds, that induces endorphins into the brain. Endorphins make you feel good. Dog's thinking, hey, this is fun. I'll remember this. Okay, that's for the casual in-between training. When you are training something for the first time and you really want to make an impression, you do the same thing. We do the same thing. Same thing. Some tug time, heavy, heavy motivation and hard play and lots of tugging and lots of ball throwing and for about 4 or 5 minutes. And what that does is induce dopamine into the brain. Now, dopamine takes a couple hours to wear off. The dopamine mimics meth and it mimics cocaine. So it is basically addictive. That's what gives the dogs that we use the big time drive. We'll do that for 4 or 5 minutes and literally park the dog, put him in his crate, park it, let him think about it for one thing, and don't let him get exposed to anything that he may relate to that high. He needs to relate only one thing to that high, and that's the scent you're training. Now, I don't know how you can do that with gun dogs. I've only had one gun dog, Brittany. I didn't do any of that stuff. She worked fine, but I never saw that dog ramped up the way we can ramp up a German Shepherd or a Malinois. And I don't know how you would do it because you've got retrieving dogs. You can't play tug with that duck when they bring it back. You know, that's not going to work. So that just takes a little thought. But the thing I would be inclined to do is what I did with my dog is heavy, heavy praise. You tell them what a good dog they are, and you tell them exactly every time they do something right, and you make sure that they know you're loving it. And they'll work harder for it. And I have found whether it's the gun dog, whether it's canine, if they do something wrong, especially when they're young and they're training, I do what I call a focused lack of reinforcement. I don't tell them no. I don't literally ignore it. And we go on to the next thing. If the dog is getting no reinforcement from a behavior, he's not going to repeat it. It's pretty much that simple.
Yep. No, it makes sense. I mean, just from the behavioral theory side of it, you know, again, reinforcement is what you do to try and make an action more likely to occur again in the future. So if you're not acknowledging it and you're not reinforcing it, all you're doing is making sure you're trying not to make it happen again in the future. And like you said, that really just comes from not acknowledging it.
That's the big thing I've seen in all types of training. Pets, working dogs, gun dogs, it's people. When the dog does something right, they start taking it for granted. You need to recognize it and you need to reward it. You said you have to acknowledge it. Let them know they're doing the right thing. And boy, it pays big dividends.
So I'm curious, you know, we have this video chat going on and I see some big game skulls on your wall behind you. Have you ever used the dogs that you've helped train for cadavers or humans? Have you ever taken any of your dogs out there on a big game track?
Yeah, not the same dog that I trained for canine. I had, again, here you go. It's a basic Montana cow dog, half border collie, half Australian shepherd. She hunted big game with me the whole time she was alive. And the way she did that, she stayed at heel. I can move her with hand signals so she didn't make any noise. Because it's not legal to have the dog chase game. But when something ran off, you know, after being wounded, that's when she came into play. What they call blood tracking now, and I learned in the course of events, you don't need blood. You just need a wounded animal. So, I used her for 10 years and she recovered about 60 some animals that I can remember for us. It's actually, if the dog has some kind of drive and you have some kind of training, it's the analogy I use, training a dog to track like that is like training a fish to swim. Put them on track and start taking notes because they know pretty much what they're doing.
I love it. I love it. Just natural ability and genetics. So I'm curious, you just spiked my interest again on the terminology of blood track. You know, when we're tracking a big game, a shot big game animal, or any animal for that matter, what are they smelling? A lot of people say that they're smelling the blood molecules in the air, you know, the drops that come out, and that's where the blood tracking comes. Not so much that they're following puddles or drops on the ground, but they're aerized. And then other people just swear that it's the foot scent, right? What's your take on that?
If there is blood, that helps, no doubt. But I've been on a number of tracks where you didn't find a drop of blood for 200 yards. What they are tracking is a wounded animal. Wounded animal, again, you're talking about VOC. Wounded animal, again, think about how dogs evolve. Will give off more epinephrine because they're scared and they don't know what's happening to them. They will have a metabolic acidosis. So a lot of the molecules that are coming off of them become acidic to a degree. And an acidic molecule is easier for a dog to pick up. It's ever so slightly irritating, the nasal business. It's so slight the dogs don't notice it. But that's what they are after, is that metabolic acidosis, those molecules. There's an increase also of diaminopentane, which is a bacterial metabolic waste product when you have dead or dying faunal tissue. And it starts right away. It starts at 0.3 seconds. So there's an increase in diaminopentane. There's an increase in epinephrine, which is a real hot scent for a dog. And there's a metabolic acidosis going on. Yeah, I don't know if you've done enough of it, but I have. I've seen the dog track. Well, the one that springs to mind instantly was in Africa once. Somebody wounded a gems buck. I don't know if you've been to Africa, but yeah. We were. The whole place is tracked up like a barnyard. It's 90 degrees outside, and we have a wiener dog as a tracking dog. And off he goes on the track. And again, I'm not finding any sign. I don't see a hoof dragging. I don't see blood. I don't see anything. But I'm following the dog. And it's like 200 yards, found a chip of bone. Well, that dude is on the right track. And sure enough, another 200 yards and we were done. How he sorted that out from 100 other animals, I wish I could say, but that's basically it. It is a change. That one animal that's wounded is giving off a different scent.
Yeah. Trust the hunter with the longest nose. And kind of what you just said, how that one dog was able to zero in on one animal. Out of all the other animals, how that was possible. It brought up another question in my head, because I don't know how familiar at all you are with the gun dog world, but you have a lot of people under the impression that if their dog hasn't ever smelled a species of bird before, that they need to be exposed to it before they go hunting it. You have a lot of people that they'll order quail wings or grouse wings or pheasant wings or something like that to put in front of their dog, so that when they go hunting on their trip a month later, they know what it smells like. Do you really think that really makes a difference to dogs, by being able to smell certain species, or is a bird a bird?
No, my impulse is, yeah, that makes a difference. From my background, we will, for instance, train drug dogs. Train explosive dog. We train dog on cocaine. Once a dog's got the idea of cocaine, we'll train him on heroin. Once he's got that, we'll train him on whatever's next, ecstasy or whatever. But we train the scents individually so the dog can recognize them. Each one, like I said, VOCs, it all goes to VOCs. Everything, the bird, whether it's a pheasant, whether it's a duck, whether it's cocaine, whether it's methamphetamine, it has a set of VOCs that come off of it in a certain ratio to each other. That's what gives it its distinctive characteristic smell. A duck smells different than a pheasant, and you know it, so you might as well let your dog know it.
I got you. So we mentioned don't let your dog's tongue lag when it gets hot. Is there anything else as hunters and trainers that we can do that you would recommend in the field do with the dogs to make sure that they stay at peak condition for smelling while they're hunting? You know, clearly keeping them watered and keeping the tongue from falling out is the biggest one. But is there anything else that you would recommend?
Keep them watered, keep them cool, keep them on a good diet, and keep them on a good exercise regimen. A healthier dog plane works better. That's all. And especially for the lab people, lab have a tendency to get fat if you give them half a chance. You don't want to give them half. It's that simple. I've done labs in search and rescue and narcotics both. They're nice, slim, trim dogs. And I would watch that. Keep them on a good diet regimen. And your gun dog guys know this already, but when it's hunting season, when you're going to be hunting them more and more, pour on some more calories, pour on some more fat for them.
Absolutely. So, Tom, I got to know, you know, you teach, you train. I want to know if you have any good war stories from actually out in the field. You know, do you have that one story? You just mentioned one out in Africa with the wiener dog. I want to know, do you have that one big story of, you know, maybe it was a human recovery or an animal recovery, something? Just what comes to mind first for you for a dog just really showing you what it's made of?
The thing comes to mind at first when I train a drug dog. I will take 1 gram, which is 1/28 of an ounce of the narcotic, say cocaine. It goes in a little Ziploc bag, just like the dopers on the street use. That goes in another Ziploc bag. This is what most people consider to be airtight. That's just how we handle it. We don't do anything different. You hide that, dog finds it. Not a problem. But I will take that as kind of part of their final exam before I put them on the street. You take that double bag, 1 gram. I will put it in a vacuum sealer. And I will put that inside a quart of oil, screw the lid on, put it in a vehicle, and the dog has to indicate on the outside of the vehicle that it's in there and go in and find it. And I have never had one not do that. That's what they're
doing. It's unreal. I swear we're just scratching the surface on what these dogs are capable of.
Yeah, along that same line, we have research from Florida State University that shows the lowest threshold of detection. And they did this, oddly enough, with a Rottweiler and a giant Schnauzer. These are not dogs noted for their scenting ability. They used amyl acetate. They got the dogs down to 1.09 parts per trillion that the dog could detect. Wow. Yeah, you can't wrap your head around that.
No, you can't. Well, and they have dogs out there now, you know, detecting cancer and diabetes and stuff in patients. It's really kind of, like I said, I think we're just scratching the surface on what these dogs can do.
I've trained diabetic, and the cancer is a whole lot easier than you would think, too. And actually, the thing I found, I just did this 2 years ago in a specialized class, and your gun dog guys might be interested. Student wanted to train a dog to shed hunt. I'd never done it before, and it turned out to be a lot easier than I thought it was going to be. So,
well, real quick, touch on that, because shed hunting, in my experience, if you take a dog out there that knows how to use its nose, you can teach that dog to shed hunt really quick. And like you just said, it's pretty simple. So walk us through how to do it real quick.
Now, the way we started this dog is we got some antlers that had not been touched. They've been hanging in the garage literally for 10, 15 years. Got some antlers, did not touch them because you have oily glands on your skin. Dogs will pick up on anything that a human has touched. So we did not touch them, used metal tongs, which we sterilized, and we would throw the antlers and start a game of fetch with the dog. Okay, once the dog figured out that this is fun, then we would, just hide them just a little out of range and send the dog. And there again, we would hide them by throwing them because otherwise the dog will track you to that spot. And we worked out from there. Now, once we got the idea into the dog's head that it needs to search and get these things and bring them back, then we started to handle them. We don't want the dog to key in on that human scent touching him. That's how we train evidence dogs for canine. So that was easy enough to figure out, too. What we did was got the antlers, which we had handled. We got a bunch of other junk, you name it, sticks, stones, forks, plates, whatever, that you have touched, and threw them all out there and sent the dog out to search. Sure enough, the dog dead bang on the antler. Because that one had the one common denominator scent, which was antler. It just turned out to be real simple. And that one, for its little final exam, I had a couple of 2-inch spikes from a little baby whitetail and took them out and threw them in the bushes and turned the dog loose.
Nice. Got them both. Nice. Well, Tom, again, I appreciate it. Maybe we'll have to have you on again sometime and talk more about dogs and some of your war stories, because it fascinates me, and what these dogs can do, it's beyond amazing.
All right, sir. Oh, I think.
Awesome. You have a good one.
Don't do it.
Everyone seems to have the same questions or concerns when they start trying to decide which kennel to purchase for their vehicle. Perhaps it's time to stop asking all the questions and just design the perfect setup that meets your exact needs. B-Pro Kennel specializes in designing and fabricating custom premier dog boxes handcrafted right here in the USA from high-grade, lightweight aluminum. They'll get you set up with the size dimensions, lighting, storage, battery boxes with solar charging, and anything else you can dream of. Stop stressing over buying the wrong setup just to replace it again in a year. Go ahead and check out bprokennels.com and get exactly what you want. If you're considering changing your dog's food soon, then be sure to check out Eukanuba Pro Performance. Their science-backed formulas are designed to take your dog to the next level of performance. They also now have the new puppy formula to help your pup start strong and live active. When looking at all the different food options, remember Eukanuba to help power their ultimate performance.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? It's Bob from Lone Ducks Gun Dog Chronicles podcast. I hope you just enjoyed the episode you just listened to. And if you did, I think you'll enjoy hopping on ours. We've got professional retriever trainers and upland bird dog trainers from across the country and world sharing their tips and tricks and great stories to help you and your dog get ready for the season. We'll see you there.